Jeff said he and Donovan used to fish at that spot with their father, long before the valley fill destroyed the creek. He took her to their old home site and described the house where they lived, the house built by his grandfather. They stopped at the cross where Donovan found their mother, Rose, and he knelt beside it for a long time. The sun was disappearing over the mountains. The afternoon had slipped away. The wind was sharper. A cold front was moving through and bringing a chance of flurries by morning. When they were back by Yellow Creek, he asked, "Do you want to stay here tonight or go back to Brady?" "Let's stay," she said. They grilled two steaks over charcoal on the porch and ate them by the fire with red wine in paper cups. When the first bottle was empty, Jeff opened a second, and they stretched out on a pile of quilts in front of the fire. They began kissing, cautiously at first. There was no hurry because there was a long night ahead of them. Their lips and tongues were stained with cheap Merlot, and they laughed about it. They talked about her past and his. He did not mention Donovan, and she was careful to avoid him also. The past was easy compared to the future. Jeff was out of a job and had no idea what he might do. It had taken him 5 years to finish 2 years of college. He wasn't much of a student. He had spent 4 months in the county jail on a drug charge, a felony that was still on his record and would haunt him for a long time. He avoided drugs now. Too many friends ruined by meth. Maybe some pot occasionally, but he wasn't much of a smoker or a drinker. They slowly got around to the topic of their love lives. Samantha talked about Henry as if the romance had been more involved than it was. Frankly, though, she'd been too busy and too exhausted to begin and maintain a serious relationship. Jeff had once been engaged to his childhood sweetheart, but his jail time disrupted their plans. While he was locked up, she ran away with another boy and broke his heart. For a long time, he took a dim view of women and treated them as if they were good for only one thing. He was mellowing now, and for the past year had been seeing a young divorcee over in Wise. She worked at the college, had a nice job, and two brats. Problem was, he couldn't stand her kids. Their father was schizophrenic, and they were showing signs. The relationship had cooled considerably. "You have your hand under my shirt," she said. "Yes, it feels good under there." "Actually, it does. It's been a long time." They finally kissed as if they meant it. A long, probing kiss, with hands groping wildly and buttons flying open. They took a break to undo belts and kick off shoes. The next kiss was more tender, but all four hands were still working, removing. When they were nice and perfectly naked, they made love by the glow of the fire. At first, their rhythms were awkward. He was a little rough and she was a little rusty, but they soon got the hang of each other's body. Round one was quick, as both needed a release. Round two was far more satisfying as they explored and changed positions. When it was over, they lay sprawled on the quilts, gently touching each other, exhausted. It was almost 9 p.m. The dusting of snow was gone by mid-morning. The sun was bright, the air clear. They hiked for an hour around Gray Mountain, hopping across dried creeks that once brimmed with rainbow and brown trout, ducking into shallow caves the boys had used as forts in another lifetime. crawling over boulders blown from the earth 2 decades ago, and meandering through trails that no one else could possibly find. Samantha wasn't sore from last night's marathon, but certain muscles seemed a bit tender. Jeff, though, seemed unfazed. Whether climbing mountains or having sex by the fire, his stamina was endless. She followed him through a gorge at the base of the mountain, then to another trail that disappeared into thick woods. They climbed rocks, part of a natural formation, and entered a cave, one that was impossible to notice from 20 feet away. Jeff turned on a flashlight and looked over his shoulder. "Are you okay?" "I'm right behind you," she said, practically clinging. "Where are we going?" "I want to show you something." They crouched low to clear a wall of rock and climbed deeper into the cave, which, but for the flashlight, was pitch black. They moved slowly, as if sneaking up on something. If he had yelled, "Snake!" she would have either fainted or died instantly from a heart attack. They entered a room, a semi-round cavern, with a ray of sunlight somehow penetrating the rock. It was a storage room, one that had been in use for some time. 2 rows of army surplus lockers stood against one wall, a stack of cardboard containers against another. A table made of a sheet of thick plywood sitting on cinder blocks held a collection of identical storage boxes. The boxes were plastic and sealed tightly. Jeff said, "We played here as kids. It's about 200 feet into the base of Gray Mountain, too deep and low to have been ruined by the mining. This room was one of our favorites because there's light and it's dry. No moisture whatsoever. And it's the same temperature year-round." Samantha pointed to the table and said, "And those would be the records you stole from coal mining, right?" He nodded with a smile and said, "Correct. I'm now an accessory to a crime. Why did you bring me here, Jeff?" "You're not an accessory because you had nothing to do with the crime, and you've never seen these boxes. You've never been here, right?" "I don't know. This doesn't feel right. Why did you bring me here?" "It's simple, Samantha, and it's not so simple. These documents have to be delivered to the other attorneys, Donovan's co-counsel, and soon. I'll figure out a way to do it, but it won't be easy. The FBI is looking. Kroll is watching. Everybody would love to catch me with the documents. Hell, I helped steal them, and now they're hidden on my family's property, so I wouldn't have much of a defense, would I?" "You're toast." "Exactly. And if something happens to me before I can deliver them, someone needs to know where they are." "And that someone is me, I suppose. You're smart enough to figure it out." "I doubt that. And who else knows about this?" "Vic Canzaro, and that's it. No one else." She took a deep breath and walked closer to the table. She said, "There's nothing simple about it, Jeff. On the one hand, these are stolen documents that could cost coal mining a fortune and force the company to clean up its mess. On the other hand, they could mean a criminal prosecution for you or whoever happens to have possession of them. Have you talked to the other lawyers? To Donovan's co-counsel?" "Not since he died. I want you to do that, Samantha. I'm not a lawyer. You are. And it needs to be done immediately. Some secret meeting where no one is watching or listening." She shook her head as she felt herself fall deeper into the spider web. Had she finally reached the point of no return? "I'll have to think about that. Why can't you and Vic meet with the lawyers?" "Vic won't do it. He's running scared. Plus, he has a lot of baggage here in the coalfields. It's a long story. Are there any short ones around here? She walked to the lockers and asked, What's in here? Our gun collection. She thought about opening one of the doors for a peek inside. But she knew nothing about guns and didn't want to learn. Without looking at him, she asked, What are the odds of finding a military sniper rifle with night vision optics and a stash of 51mm cartridges? She turned and stared at him. But he looked away and said, I wouldn't open that if I were you. She headed for the entrance, brushed beside him, and said, Let's get out of here. They left the cave and were soon zigzagging along the trails. It occurred to Samantha that if something did happen to Jeff, she could never find her way back to the cave. And furthermore, if something happened to Jeff, she would be back in Manhattan before Maddie could organize another funeral. Nothing was said for a long time. They shared a can of bad chili on the porch for lunch, washed it down with the last of the wine, and took a nap by the fire. When the naps were over, they found themselves kissing and groping again. The same clothes eventually came off again, tossed haphazardly around the room. And they spent a delightful Sunday afternoon together. Chapter 29. Phoebe Fanning's bail was reduced from $100,000 to a mere $1,000, and at 9 a.m. Monday morning, she posted it through a bondsman. The deal came about after Samantha successfully badgered the judge into releasing the mother while the father remained in jail. The well-being of three innocent children was on the line. And after 2 days of harassment, the judge had come around. Phoebe's court-appointed defense attorney claimed to be overworked and had little time for the preliminary matters. Thus, Samantha had stepped in to secure the release. She walked out of the courthouse with Phoebe and drove her home. She waited with her there for an hour while a distant cousin brought the kids over. They had not seen their mother in over a week and had obviously been warned that she would likely serve time. There were a lot of tears and hugging and so on, and Samantha was quickly bored with it. She had carefully explained to Phoebe that she was facing a minimum of 5 years in prison, much more for Randy if he took the fall, and that she needed to prepare her children for the inevitable catastrophe. As she was leaving the Fannings, her cell phone buzzed. It was Maddie at the office. She had just received the news that Francine Crump had been stricken with a severe stroke and was in the hospital. The saga of the free last will and testament continued. At the hospital, a frightening and antiquated facility that should have inspired healthy habits in every citizen in Nolan County, Samantha found a nurse in the ICU who could spare a word or two. The patient had been brought in just after midnight, unresponsive, and with almost no blood pressure. A CT scan revealed a massive hemorrhagic stroke or severe bleeding into the brain. She had been intubated and was comatose. Things are not good, the nurse said with a deep frown. Looks like she went hours before they found her. Plus, she's 80 years old. Because she was not a member of the family, Samantha was not allowed to peek into the ICU and see who might be sitting with Francine. When she returned to the office, there were phone messages from Jonah and Delos Crump. As their mother lay dying, they were desperate to chat about her estate. If Francine had a new will, it had not been prepared by the attorneys at the Mountain Legal Aid Clinic. If there was no new will, and if Francine remained comatose until she died, then it was abundantly clear that Samantha would be dealing with these unpleasant people for many months to come. A hot will contest was taking shape. She decided to ignore the calls for the moment. All five siblings were probably racing to Brady, and she would hear from them soon enough. The firm's brown bag lunch that Monday was spent digesting some ominous news. As Maddie had warned, the attorneys for Strayhorn Cole were reneging on their agreement to settle the Tate wrongful death case. They had sent her a letter as the presumed attorney for Donovan's estate and said that they would not settle. Instead, they were aggressively appealing the verdict. She had fired back an email with the flippant suggestion that they should try and control their aggression. Her theory was that they were willing to push the appeal, hope for a reversal, and roll the dice in a retrial with Donovan out of the way. Such a retrial would be 3 years down the road at the earliest, and while they waited and got paid to stall, their client's money would be hard at work elsewhere. Annette was incensed and pushed Maddie to bring the matter to the attention of the judge. Strayhorn and Donovan had an agreement to settle for $1.7 million. It was unfair, even unconscionable, for the defendant to back out simply because the plaintiff's attorney was now dead. Maddie agreed. However, so far no one in Donovan's office could find anything in writing. It looked as though they reached a deal on the phone, but no settlement memo was prepared before he died. Without written guidelines, she doubted the court would force the settlement. She had consulted with a trial lawyer friend and a retired judge. Both thought they were out of luck. She planned to have a chat with the trial judge, off the record, and get some idea of what he was thinking. The bottom line was that it looked as though the estate would be forced to hire a lawyer to handle the appeal. On another subject, Barb reported that the office had received 11 phone calls that morning from the Crump clan, all demanding to see Ms. Kofer. Ms. Kofer said she planned to schedule a meeting later that afternoon. Not surprisingly, both Maddie and Annette had busy schedules with no time for the Crumps. Samantha rolled her eyes and said, "Fine, but these folks are not going away." Francine died at 4:30 that afternoon. She never regained consciousness, nor did she get around to revising the will Samantha prepared. Early Tuesday afternoon, Jeff eased through the rear door and was standing at Samantha's desk before she realized it. Each smiled and said hello, but there was no movement toward anything more affectionate. Her door was open, and as always, the place was filled with incredibly nosy women. He sat down and said, "So, when would you like to go hiking again?" She put a finger to her lips and softly said, "Whenever I can work it into my schedule." She had thought about sex more in the last 24 hours than at any time in the last 2 years since she broke up with Henry. "I'll have to check with my secretary," she said. She still found it hard to believe that someone might be listening to conversations in her office, but she was taking no chances. And given his paranoia, he was saying almost nothing. He managed, "Okay. Would you like some coffee?" "No." "Then we'd better go." They walked down the hall to the front conference room, where Maddie was waiting. At precisely 2 p.m., Agents Banahan, Frohmeyer, and Zimmer arrived in a rush, and with such grim determination, it seemed as if they might shoot first and ask questions later. Frohmeyer had led the troops during the raid on Donovan's office. Zimmer had been one of his gophers. Banahan had stopped by earlier. After quick introductions were made, they squared off, with Jeff sitting between Maddie and Samantha on one side, and the government on the other. Annette held one end of the table and turned on a recorder. Maddie again asked if Jeff was the subject of an investigation by the FBI, the U.S. attorney, any other federal law enforcement agency, or anyone working for the Department of Justice. Frohmeyer assured her he was not. Frohmeyer took charge and spent a few minutes digging through Jeff's background. Samantha took notes. After their rather intimate weekend, in which he had shared so much, she learned nothing new. Frohmeyer probed his relationship with his deceased brother. How long had he worked for him? What did he do? How much was he paid? As coached by Maddie and Annette, Jeff gave succinct answers and never offered anything extra. Lying to an FBI agent is a crime in itself, regardless of where or how the interrogation takes place. Whatever you do, Maddie had said repeatedly, do not lie. Like his brother, Jeff had seemed perfectly willing to lie if it would help the cause. He assumed the bad guys, the coal companies and now the government, would cut corners and cheat and do whatever to win. If they played dirty, why couldn't he? Because, Maddie had repeated, you can be sent to prison. The coal companies and their lawyers cannot. Working from scripted notes, Frohmeyer finally got around to the important matters. He explained that the computers seized by the FBI 1 week ago on December 1st had been tampered with. The hard drives had been replaced. Did Jeff know anything about that? Maddie snapped, don't answer that. She explained to Frohmeyer that she had spoken with the U.S. attorney and that it was clear that Donovan died without knowing that he was the subject of a new investigation. He had not been informed. There was nothing in writing. Therefore, with respect to his office files and records, any actions taken by his employees after his death were not done to impede an investigation. Off the record, Jeff's version was that he removed the hard drives from the office and home computers and burned them. Samantha suspected, though, that they still existed. Not that it mattered. Jeff had assured her that there was nothing important, relative to coal mining, to be found in any of Donovan's computers. And I know where the records are, Samantha thought to herself, almost in disbelief. The fact that Maddie had gone to the U.S. attorney irritated Frohmeyer. She didn't care. They haggled for a while over the questioning, and it became obvious who was in control, at least in this meeting. If Maddie told Jeff not to answer, Frohmeyer got nothing. He told the story of a bunch of records that disappeared from the headquarters of Kroll Mining near Harlan, Kentucky, and asked Jeff if he knew anything about it. Jeff shrugged and shook his head no before Maddie could say, don't answer that. Do you plead the Fifth Amendment? Frohmeyer asked in frustration. He's not under oath, Maddie shot back, as if Frohmeyer was stupid. Samantha had to confess, at least to herself, that she was thoroughly enjoying the conflict. The FBI with all its power on one side. Jeff, their client, who was certainly guilty of something on the other side, heavily protected by legal talent and winning for the moment. I guess we're wasting our time, Frohmeyer said, throwing up his hands. Thanks for the hospitality. I'm sure we'll be back. Don't mention it, Maddie said. And no contact with my client unless I'm notified. Got it? We'll see, Frohmeyer said like a jerk as he kicked back his chair and stood. Banahan and Zimmer marched out with him. An hour later, Samantha, Maddie, and Jeff were sitting in the back row in the main courtroom, waiting on the judge who would oversee the probate of Donovan's estate. Court was not in session, and a handful of lawyers milled about the bench, swapping jokes with the clerks. Jeff said quietly, I'll talk to our experts this morning. So far, they've found no evidence of anyone tampering with Donovan's Cessna. The crash was caused by sudden engine failure, and the engine quit because the flow of fuel was cut off. The tank was full. We always filled up in Charleston because it's cheaper there. The miracle is that the plane did not burst into flames and burn a hole in the ground. How did the fuel get cut off? Maddie asked. That's the big question. If you believe it was sabotage, Then there's one real strong theory. There's a fuel line that runs from the fuel pump to the carburetor, where it's attached by what's called a B-nut. If the B-nut is deliberately loosened, the engine will start up just fine and operate smoothly until the vibration causes the B-nut to slowly unscrew itself. The fuel line will come loose, and engine failure is imminent. The engine will sputter and quickly shut down completely. Happens very fast with no warning, no alarm, and it's impossible to restart it. If a pilot is staring at his fuel gauge, which is something we glance at only periodically, then he might notice a sudden drop in fuel pressure at about the same time the engine begins to die. They make a big deal out of the fact that Donovan did not make a distress call. That's nonsense. Think about it. You're flying along at night, and suddenly your engine quits. You have a few seconds to react, but it's total panic. You try to restart the engine, but that doesn't work. You're thinking about 10 things at once, but the last thing you're thinking about is calling for help. How the hell is anyone going to help? How easy is it to tamper with the B-nut? Samantha asked. It's not difficult if you know what you're doing. The trick is to do it without getting caught. You would have to wait until dark, sneak onto the tie-down area of the ramp, remove the cowling that covers the engine, use a flashlight and a wrench, and do your business. One expert said it can be done in about 20 minutes. On the night in question, there were 17 other small aircraft tied down in the same area. But there was almost no traffic that night. The ramp was very quiet. We've checked the surveillance videos from the General Aviation Terminal and found nothing. We've talked to the ramp guys on duty that night, and they saw nothing. We've checked the maintenance records with the mechanic in Roanoke, and of course, everything was working fine when he signed off on the last inspection. How badly was the engine damaged? Asked Maddie. It's a mess. Evidently, the Cessna clipped some trees. It looks like Donovan was trying to land on a county highway. He might have seen the headlights of a car, but who knows? And when he hit the trees, the plane pitched forward and landed nose first. The engine was smashed, and it's impossible to determine the position of the B-nut. It's fairly easy to conclude that the fuel was cut off. But beyond that, there aren't many clues. The judge entered the courtroom and assumed the bench. He scanned the audience and said something to a clerk. What's next? Samantha whispered. We'll keep digging, Jeff said, but with little confidence. The judge looked toward the rear of the courtroom and said, Ms. Wyatt. Maddie introduced Jeff to His Honor, who politely passed along his condolences and said nice things about Donovan. Jeff thanked him as Maddie began producing orders for the judge to sign. The judge took his time reading the will and commented on various provisions. He and Maddie discussed the strategy of the estate hiring a lawyer to pursue the Tate appeal. Jeff was quizzed about Donovan's financial status, his assets, and debts. After an hour, all orders were signed, and the estate was officially opened. Maddie stayed on to handle another matter, but Jeff was dismissed. As he walked back to the office with Samantha, he said, I'm disappearing for a few weeks, so use the prepaid phone. Any place in particular? No. No surprise there. I'm leaving myself for the holidays. Washington and then New York. I guess I won't be seeing you for a while. So is this Merry Christmas and Happy New Year? I suppose so. Merry Christmas and Happy New Year. He stopped and quickly pecked her on the cheek. Same to you. He turned onto a side street and hurried away, as if someone might be trailing him. The funeral for Francine Crump was held at 11 a.m. Wednesday in a holiness church deep in the hollows. Samantha never considered attending the service. Annette strongly advised against it, since it was likely they would pull out the snakes and start dancing. Samantha took this seriously. Annette later admitted she was exaggerating. There were no known snake-handling congregations still practicing in Virginia, she explained. All the members are dead. But a nest of angry rattlers could not have been worse than the mob of crumps that showed up later in the day for a showdown with Mrs. Kofor. They descended upon the clinic with a show of force unlike any Maddie had ever seen. The five siblings, some of their current spouses, a few of their large children, and a few assorted blood relatives. Their beloved mother was dead, and it was time to split the money. Maddie took charge and told most of them to leave. Only the five siblings would be allowed to take part in the meeting. The rest could go sit in their trucks. She and Annette herded them into a conference room, and when they were seated, Samantha walked in and joined them. Collectively, they were a mess. They had just buried their mother. They were terrified they might lose the family land, and whatever money that meant. And they were bitter at the lawyers for facilitating this. They were also getting pestered by relatives who'd heard rumors of coal money. They were away from home and missing work, and, as Samantha suspected, they had been fighting amongst themselves. She began by explaining that no lawyer at the clinic had prepared another will for their mother. Indeed, no one had heard a word from Francine since the last family meeting at that very table some 9 days earlier. If Francine told them otherwise, then it simply wasn't true. Nor did Samantha know of any other lawyer in town who might have prepared a new will. Maddie explained that it was customary, though by no means obligatory, for one lawyer to call another when a different will is prepared. At any rate, as far as they knew, the will signed by Francine 2 months earlier was her last will and testament. They listened and fumed, barely able to control their loathing for the lawyers. As Samantha wound down, she expected a torrent of abuse, probably from all five. Instead, there was a long pause. Jonah, the oldest at 61, finally said, "Mama destroyed the will." Samantha had no response. Annette frowned as her mind raced back to the old Virginia statutes regarding lost and destroyed wills. Maddie was impressed at the cleverness of their scheme and could barely suppress a grin. Jonah went on, "I'm sure you have a copy of the will, but as I understand things, when she destroyed the original, the copy became useless. That right?" Maddie nodded along, acknowledging the obvious fact that Jonah had paid for some quick legal advice. And why would he pay a lawyer for advice and not for a new will? Because Francine wouldn't agree to a new will. "How do you know she destroyed it?" she asked. Unifae said, "She told me last week," Irma said. "Told me too. Said she burned it in the fireplace." Delos added, "And we've looked everywhere and can't find it." It was all very well rehearsed. And as long as the five stuck together, the story would hold up. On cue, Lonnie asked, "And so if there's no will, then we get the land in five equal shares, right?" "I suppose," Maddie said. "I'm not sure what position the Mountain Trust will take." Jonah growled, "You tell the Mountain Trust to get lost, you hear? Hell, they never knew about our property until y'all brought them in. This is our family land, always has been." His four siblings agreed wholeheartedly. In a flash, Samantha switched teams. If Francine had in fact destroyed the will, or if these five were lying and there was no way to prove otherwise, then give them the damned 80 acres and say goodbye. The last thing she wanted was a will contest between the Crumps and the Mountain Trust, with her as the star witness, taking flack from both sides. She never wanted to see these people again. Nor did Annette and Maddie. They switched too, with Maddie saying, "Look, folks, we as lawyers will not try and probate the will. That's not our job. I doubt seriously if the Mountain Trust wants to get bogged down in a protracted will contest. The legal fees will cost more than the land is worth. If there's no will, then there's no will. Y'all need to find a lawyer who will open the estate and get an administrator appointed." "Do y'all do that?" Jonah asked. All three lawyers recoiled in horror at the notion of representing these people. Annette managed to speak first. "Oh, no, we can't because we prepared the will." "But it's pretty routine stuff," Maddie added quickly. "Almost any lawyer along Main Street can do it." Una Faye actually smiled and said, "Well, thanks." Lonnie asked, "And we split it five ways, right?" Maddie said, "That's the law, but you need to check with your lawyer." Lonnie was shifty-eyed to begin with, and he was already looking around the room. They would be fighting before they left Brady. And there were relatives waiting outside, ready to pounce on all that coal money. They left in peace, and when the front door closed behind the last one, the three lawyers felt like celebrating. They locked the door, kicked off their shoes, and piled into the conference room for a late afternoon sip of wine and a lot of laughs. Annette attempted to describe the scene of the first one home, rummaging through the house in a desperate search for that damned will. Then the second, then the third. Their mother was on the slab at the funeral home, and they were knocking over furniture and dumping out drawers in a frantic search. If they found it, they certainly burned it. Not one of the three lawyers believed Francine actually destroyed her will. And they were right. The original arrived in the mail the following day, with a note from Francine asking Samantha to please protect it. The Crumps would be back after all. Chapter 30. For the third year in a row, Karen Cofer spent Christmas in New York City with her daughter. She had a close friend from college whose third husband was an aging industrialist, now sidelined by dementia and tucked away in a plush retirement home in Great Neck. Their rambling apartment on Fifth Avenue overlooked Central Park and was practically deserted. Karen was given her own suite for the week and treated like a queen. Samantha was offered one too, but chose instead to stay with Blythe in their apartment in Soho. The lease expired on December 31st, and she needed to pack her things and make arrangements to store furniture. Blythe, still hanging on at the world's fourth largest law firm, was moving in with two friends in Chelsea. After 3 months in Brady, Samantha felt liberated in the city. She shopped with her mother in Midtown, battling the crowds, but enjoying the frenetic energy. She had late afternoon drinks with friends in all the right, trendy bars, and while enjoying the scene, found herself bored with the conversation. Careers, real estate, and the Great Recession. Karen sprang for two tickets to a Broadway musical, a rage that was nothing more than a made-for-tourist ripoff. They left at intermission and got a table at Orso. Samantha had brunch with an old Georgetown pal at Balthazar, where the friend almost squealed as she pointed out a famous TV actor Samantha had never seen nor heard of. She took long, solitary walks through Lower Manhattan. Christmas dinner was a feast at the Fifth Avenue apartment with a bunch of strangers. Though after a lot of wine, the conversation loosened up, and an ordeal became a riot that went on for hours. Samantha slept in a spare bedroom, one bigger than her apartment, and woke up with a mild hangover. A uniformed maid brought her orange juice, coffee, and ibuprofen. She had lunch with Henry, who had been pestering her, and realized they had nothing in common. He was assuming she would be back in the city in the near future and was eager to rekindle something. She tried to explain that she wasn't sure when she would return. There was no job waiting for her, and now no apartment. Her future was uncertain, as was his. He'd given up on acting and was considering an entry into the exciting world of hedge fund management. An odd choice these days, she thought. Aren't those guys bleeding cash and dodging indictments? His undergraduate degree from Cornell was in Arabic. He was headed to nowhere, and she would not waste another minute with him. 2 days after Christmas, she was sitting in a coffee bar in Soho when a phone buzzed. At first, she didn't recognize the noise deep in her purse, then realized it was the prepaid phone Jeff had given her. She found it just in time and said hello. "Happy New Year," he said. "Where are you?" "Same to you. I'm in the city. Where are you?" "In the city? I'd like to see you. Got time for some coffee?" For a moment, she thought he was joking. She couldn't imagine Jeff Gray walking the streets of Manhattan, but then, why not? The city attracted all types from everywhere. "Sure. In fact, I'm having coffee right now. Alone."
"What's the address?"
While she waited, she became amused at her thought process. Her initial reaction was one of surprise, which was immediately followed by one of pure lust. How could she get him into her apartment and avoid Blythe? Not that Blythe would really care, but she didn't want a lot of questions. Where was he staying? A nice hotel? That would work. Was he alone? Or sharing a room with a friend? "Settle down, girl," she told herself. He walked in 20 minutes later, and they kissed on the lips. As they waited on double espressos, she asked him the obvious. "What are you doing here?" "I've been here before," he said. "I'm moving around these days, and I wanted to see you." "A call would have been nice." Faded jeans, black t-shirt, wool sports coat, chukka boots, 3 days' growth, hair just slightly untamed. He was definitely not one of the Wall Street clones, but in Soho, no one would suspect him of being from backwater Appalachia. And who would care? In reality, he looked more like an unemployed actor than Henry. "I wanted to surprise you." "Okay, I'm surprised. How did you get here?" "A private jet. It's a long story." "I'm so tired of long stories." "Where are you staying?"
"The Hilton, Midtown."
"Alone?"
"Where are you staying?"
"My apartment, for a few more days anyway. Then the lease is up." The barista said their coffee was ready, and Jeff grabbed the two cups. He poured in a pack of sugar and stirred slowly. She passed on the sugar. They huddled closer together as the coffee bar became crowded. She said, "So can we get back to this private jet matter? Care to elaborate?"
"I'm here for two reasons. First, I want to see you and maybe spend a little time together. Perhaps we could hike, you know, around the city and then find a fireplace somewhere. If not, maybe just a nice warm bed. That's what I'd like. But I understand if you're too busy. I'm not crashing your private time, okay?
You can forget the fireplace."
"Got it. I'm available from this moment on.
I'm sure we'll find time. And what about the other reason?"
"Well, the jet is owned by a trial lawyer named Jarrett London from Louisville. You may have heard of him by now. And how would I know a lawyer from Louisville? Anyway, he and Donovan were very close. In fact, Jarrett was at the funeral. Tall guy, about 60, with long gray hair and a salt and pepper beard. Donovan considered him to be his mentor, almost his hero. His law firm is one of the other three who sued coal mining in the Hammer Valley case. They got raided the same day the FBI raided our office. Needless to say, a guy like London doesn't appreciate such Gestapo tactics, and he's spitting fire. Big ego, typical of the breed. She was nodding. My father. Yes, of course. In fact, London says he met your father years ago at some trial lawyer shindig. Anyway, London has a new girlfriend, a real dingbat, and she wanted to see the city. I hitched a ride. How convenient. He also wants to meet you, say hello, and talk about the documents. What documents? Come on, Jeff. I'm already in too deep. Where is this going? You gotta help me here, Samantha. My brother is gone, and I need someone to talk to. Someone who knows the law and can give me advice. Her spine stiffened, and she pulled back. She glared at him and wanted to lash out. Instead, she glanced around, swallowed hard, and said, "You are deliberately sucking me into a conspiracy that can land me in serious trouble. The FBI is all over this. Yet you want me to get involved? You're as reckless as your brother, and you don't care what happens to me. Look, who says I'm even going back to Brady, Virginia? I feel incredibly safe right now. This is my home. It's where I belong." His lanky frame seemed to shrink by inches as his chin dropped. He looked lost and helpless. "I do care about you, Samantha. And I care what happens to you. I just need help right now. Jeff, we had a wonderful time a couple of weeks ago at Gray Mountain. I've thought about it a lot. But what I don't understand is why you took me to that cave, or whatever the hell it's called, and showed me the documents. At that, no one will ever know. At that point, I became an accessory of some sort. I realize the documents are valuable and damaging and all that, but it doesn't change the fact that they're stolen. Someone has to know where they are, Samantha, in case something happens to me. Let Vic handle it. I told you, Vic is gone, checked out. His girlfriend is pregnant and he's a changed man. He's not risking anything. He will not answer the phone. He's smart. The espresso was getting cold. Jeff noticed his and took a sip. Samantha ignored him and studied the crowd. Finally, Jeff said, "Can we get out of here?" They found a bench in Washington Square Park. All the benches were empty because the wind was howling and the temperature was just below freezing. "How much does this London guy know about me?" she asked. "He knows you have the Reiser case, at least the black lung part. He knows you discovered the fraud and cover-up by the lawyers for Lone Rock Coal. He's really impressed by that. He knows that I trust you, and that Donovan trusted you. He knows that Donovan told you about the documents. Does he know I've seen them?" "No. I told you, Samantha. No one will ever know that. I was wrong to take you there. Thank you. Let's at least meet with the guy and see what he says. Please? There's no harm in that, right?" "I don't know." "Yes, you do know. There's nothing even remotely out of bounds in meeting with Jarrett London. It will be extremely confidential. Plus, he's an interesting guy. When does he want to meet? I'll call him. I'm freezing. Do you live around here? Not far, but the apartment is a mess. We're packing up. I don't care. 2 hours later, Samantha walked into the lobby of the Peninsula Hotel on 55th Street in Midtown. She took the stairs to her left, climbed one floor, and saw Jeff sitting at the bar, as expected. Without a word, he handed her a scrap of paper with the message, "Room 1926. He watched her turn around and leave, then stood by the stairs to see if anyone else noticed. She took the elevator to the 19th floor and pressed the buzzer to the room. A tall man, with far too much gray hair, opened the door within seconds and said, "Hello, Ms. Kofer. It's an honor. I'm Jarrett London." Number 1926 was a huge suite with an entire den at one end. There was no sign of the girlfriend. Minutes after Samantha arrived, Jeff buzzed the door. They sat in the den and went through the required pleasantries. London mentioned something to drink, but everyone declined. He brought up her work in the riser case and gushed on about how brilliant it was. He and Donovan had discussed it at length. London and his partners were still debating whether their firm should jump in the lawsuit with Donovan when he went ahead and filed the damn thing. "Much too premature," London said. But then, that was Donovan. He, London, was still considering the litigation. It's not every day you catch a major law firm like Casper Slate committing fraud red-handed, you know. The case could have enormous jury appeal, and so on. He went on and on about the beauty of the case, as if Samantha had never realized this. She'd heard it before, from Donovan, and from her father. Now on to Kroll Mining. With Donovan out of the picture, London was now lead counsel for the plaintiffs. The lawsuit had been filed on October 29th. Kroll had been granted additional time to respond and file an answer. In early January, London and his team were expecting Kroll to file a serious motion to dismiss, and the war would commence at full throttle. Soon, very soon, they would need the documents. "How much do you know about them?" Samantha asked. London exhaled loudly, as if the question was so loaded he had no idea where to begin. Then he stood and walked to the minibar. "Beer, anyone?" Jeff and Samantha declined, again. He opened a Heineken and walked to a window. He took a long swig and said, "About a year ago, we had our first meeting in Charleston. Offices of Gordy Mace, one of our gang. Donovan had summoned all of us there to pitch the Hammer Valley lawsuit. He said he had possession of some documents, and the possession had not come about through the usual methods. We didn't ask. He didn't offer. Said there were over 20,000 pages of highly incriminating stuff. Kroll Mining knew about the contamination, knew it was leaking into the groundwater up and down the valley, knew people were still drinking the water, knew people were suffering and dying, knew it should clean up the site, but also knew it was less expensive to just screw the people and keep the money. He did not have the documents with him, but he had extensive notes. Notes he destroyed after the meeting. He described about 20 of the documents, the most damaging ones. And frankly, we were blown away, stunned, outraged. We signed on immediately and geared up for the lawsuit. Donovan was careful not to refer to the documents as stolen, and he kept them away from us. If he had given us the documents at any point during the past year, all of us, in all likelihood, would have been arrested earlier this month by the FBI. So how do you take possession of the documents now and avoid being arrested? She asked. That's the great question. We're having indirect talks with one of the trial judge's law clerks. Real back-channel stuff that's highly sensitive and highly unusual. We think we'll be able to take the documents, immediately tender them to the court, and have them locked away by the judge. We will then ask him to lean on the U.S. attorney to back off the criminal investigation until the documents are reviewed. Let's face it, the person who stole the documents is dead. We've consulted with our criminal defense attorneys, and they agree that our exposure will be minimal. We are willing to take the risks. The danger is, what might happen to the documents before they reach the court? Kroll Mining will do anything to destroy them. And right now, they have the FBI on their side. It's dangerous out there. Samantha gave Jeff a look that could kill. London sat near Samantha and looked deep into her eyes. We could use some help in Washington. I'm sorry? The Attorney General has three people in his inner circle. One is Leona Kent. I'm sure you know her. Reeling, Samantha said. I've met her years back. She and your mother started at Justice at the same time, 30 years ago. Your mother is highly regarded and has seniority. She also has some pull, but not in areas like this. Oh yes, Samantha. A word or two from Karen Kofor to Leona Kent, and from Leona Kent to the Attorney General, and from the AG to the U.S. Attorney in Kentucky, and we could see the FBI back off. That would leave us with only the Kroll thugs to worry about. Is that what this meeting is about? My mother? Professionally, Samantha, not personally. You understand. Have you discussed this with your mother? No, of course not. In fact, I haven't even thought about discussing it with her. This is out of her league, okay? I don't think so. We have serious contacts in D.C., and they believe Karen Kofor could help us. Samantha was bewildered and at a loss. She looked at Jeff and asked, Is this why you came to New York? To get my mother involved? He quickly replied, No, this is the first I've heard of it. I didn't even know where your mother worked. He was as sincere as a little boy being falsely accused, and she believed him. I didn't discuss it with him, Samantha, London said. This is coming from our insiders in D.C. Your lobbyists. Yes, of course. Don't we all have lobbyists? Love 'em or hate 'em, but they know the landscape. I'm afraid you're taking this too personally. We're not asking you to ask your mother to get directly involved in a federal investigation. But at the same time, we understand how things work. People are people. Friends are friends. A quiet word here and there and things can happen. Just think about it, okay? Samantha took a deep breath and said, I'll consider thinking about it. Thank you. He stood and stretched his legs again. She glared at Jeff, who was studying his boots. Rather awkwardly, London said, Now, Jeff, can we discuss the delivery of the documents? Samantha jumped to her feet and said, I'll see you guys later. Jeff grabbed her arm gently and said, Please, Samantha, don't go. I need your input here. She shook free and said, I'm not a part of your little conspiracy. You boys chat all you want to. You don't need me. It's been a pleasure. She yanked open the door and disappeared. Jeff caught her in the lobby, and they left the hotel together. He apologized, and she assured him she was not upset. She didn't know Jarrett London, certainly didn't trust him as a stranger, and wasn't about to discuss sensitive issues in his presence. They drifted up Fifth Avenue, lost in the crowd, and managed to move the conversation away from anything related to Cole. She pointed out the building where her mother was currently living in luxury. She was expected at yet another dinner party there later in the evening, but she had already canceled. She had promised the night to Jeff. Suspecting that he might not appreciate a 3-hour marathon in a 4-star restaurant, she avoided the fancy places and got a table at Moss in the West Village. On a frigid night, it was the perfect choice. Warm and cozy, with the ambiance of a real French farmhouse. The menu changed daily and was not extensive. Jeff read through it once and confessed he didn't recognize any of the dishes. A waiter suggested the 4-course fixed-price offering for $68, and Samantha agreed. Jeff was appalled at the price, but soon impressed with the food. Shrimp crusted with spaghetti squash, pork and apple sausage, wild-striped bass with leek fondue, and a chocolate tort. They drank a bottle of Syrah from the Rhone Valley. When the cheese cart rolled by, Jeff almost chased it. Samantha called the waiter over and explained that they would like to add a cheese course, with more wine. As they waited for the cart, Jeff leaned closer and said, "Will you think about something?" "I'm not promising anything. I'm not sure I trust you." "Thanks. Look, this may sound crazy, and I've really struggled with the idea of even mentioning this to you. So, I'm still struggling, but here it is." For one horrible split second, Samantha thought he was going to propose marriage. They weren't even a couple, and she had no plans to get serious. So far, they had put sex before any hint of love. Surely this somewhat rustic mountain boy wasn't smitten enough to stumble into a proposal. He wasn't, but his idea was almost as unsettling. He said, "I own the office building, or I will at some point after probate. I'm also the executor of Donovan's estate, so I'm in charge of his business. Me, Maddie, and the judge, I guess. You've seen the list of his cases. He left a lot of work behind. Maddie will take a few cases, but not many. Her desk is busy enough, and it's not her type of work. What we need is